So this week, Jerome Powell was doing testimony before both Senate and Congress because some of the questions that were coming from the people running our country was absolutely horrifying as to how uneducated, if these were true questions and not political theater, and again, hoping it's political theater, it suggests that the people running our country have absolutely no understanding of the basics of economics. And mind you, these are the people sitting on the board of the Senate Banking Committee, as an example.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Welcome you back to another weekly market recap here at the end of the week with my good friend Lance Roberts. Lance, how you doing, buddy?
Well, I'm doing great, but apparently I've pissed off a lot of people on Twitter today, so you may have no followers. So,
isn't that just a regular day on Twitter for you, Lance?
Pretty much. I tend to rile up feathers, but I do it mostly out of fun. I like to throw bombs out there and just watch people kind of go feeding frenzy over them.
Yeah. Well, Twitter is a great place if you want to, if you want to generate some outrage. It's pretty easy to do there.
Exactly.
That being said, folks, if you're on Twitter, follow Lance at Lance Roberts and me at Menlo Bear. Yep. All right. Well, Lance, look, I got a ton to dig into. So let's just kick it off real quick with a quick market recap here. Up week for the markets. So folks are maybe hoping the beatings, maybe at least temporarily over. Can you just sort of give us the quick synopsis of the week that was?
Absolutely. This was not surprising this week at all. In fact, we have been kind of writing about this, and in our 3-minute videos, we've been talking about this as well. As, if we go back, to last week, and I know that seems like a bajillion years ago now, we had the Fed, get ready to hike interest rates by 75 basis points, and we were all concerned about the CPI inflation print, and we had that massive $3.2 trillion OPEX, and, the markets just kind of cascaded lower, heading into last week. And so, markets have gotten really washed out here on a short-term basis. Some interesting kind of statistics, you take a look at the number of stocks. Now, this was as of last week, this has been repaired this week to a little bit of a degree. But last Friday, only 2% of stocks were above their 50-day moving average in the S&P 500. Only 12% were above their 200-day moving average. Now, all that means is those are levels of kind of washed out territory that you only see at short-term market bottoms. Now, this week, again, there's been a repair of some of that data coming off those lows because the market rallied. We were up about 5.5-6% this week. So nice, healthy rally coming off those lows. Now, but the problem here is, and we should get some additional rally next week. We have not reversed that oversold condition. We're just turning up on some very short-term buy signals. So we should get some follow through next week because next week is end of the quarter for the second quarter. So all these mutual funds, pension funds, anybody that runs the balanced allocation model, all those, hedge fund managers, all this, they've got to do quarterly reporting. And so there are a lot of them are underweight equities right now. They've been selling or getting sold off, unintentionally if they had a lot of margin debt. That's been getting liquidated over the last quarter. So they're going to have to rebalance those books next week. So that's going to provide a little bit of buying support for the market. So I would expect, as these funds kind of rebalance and put some cash back to work to get their portfolios set up for what we call window dressing, that we'll get a little bit more of this follow through. Here's the technical problem that we have going on though. Any rally that we get, so if you go back and pull a chart of the S&P and just look at that kind of cascade waterfall that we had after that, we talked about previously in May that we were oversold and going to get a rally. We had a little bit of a rally, lasted a couple of weeks. Then we had this cascade waterfall. And there's these big gaps that are coming down. We had 3 days where the market just gapped lower every morning. The bottoms of each one of those gaps are now going to be resistance as this market tries to rally. So there's three levels of really tough resistance ahead as we try to fill those gaps. And when we fill those gaps, that's going to get us up towards the 50-day moving average. That's about 4,000 on the S&P. So not that far away from where we closed the market today, but a lot of resistance. And if you just kind of think about this, the market's trying to swim upstream right now, and it's a pretty strong current. So it's, I can't, you know, I'm not saying that it absolutely can't happen, that we can't break out and move to, you know, move further up the chain. We certainly could, but every day that we move going forward, we're going to keep hitting these levels of resistance, whether it's these gaps or the 50-day moving average or the 200-day moving average just above that. I mean, it's just one level of challenge for the markets. And as we've been saying, there's a lot of people that are trapped in this market. This market sold off, and particularly that the really sharp drop that we had, you know, a week or so ago, that trapped a lot of people in this market. And they're just kind of hoping that this rally is going to be enough for them to kind of get out, repair some of that damage. I just want to get out. And that's what we call trap long. So we still have a lot of that selling that's sitting there. So every time the market rallies, it's going to get met by selling. And that's probably what we'll see into the next week or so. But use the rally we get next week. If you have, you know, if you're kind of in a position where, you know, this market's really starting to weigh on you, you've got, you know, and you're kind of feeling like you need to do something, use this rally to kind of rebalance your equity allocation, reduce some risk, raise some cash. You know, it's kind of been that same message every week here with you, Adam. That's, you know, it's like, hey, as soon as we get this rally, reduce risk, rebalance, you know, and do that type of thing. And that's what we continue to do with our portfolios as well. And you know, I would suggest continuing to do that same thing in the next week or so.
Okay, great. And I was just about to ask you, you answered the question, but you're staying on the same train that you've been consistent about, which is use any rallies at this point as an opportunity to lighten up and to sell. Yeah. All right. A couple quick questions. First is, next week is end of the quarter, as you said, and we're going to have those dynamics going on. It's also going into the July 4th weekend. So shorter trading week the next week, people beginning to go on vacations, et cetera. Sometimes there's an argument that when sort of Wall Street goes on holiday, you don't really get a lot of down action in the markets because folks are not trading that much. And also nobody really wants to ruin their vacations, you know? So could there be a little bit of that going on in the next week or two where just people aren't?
No, absolutely. You know, here's the thing. So, you know, the reason we're kind of hanging on to the strategy right now of selling rallies is because there's a lot of technical damage to the market, and there's no indication right now that we're really forming a lasting bottom. And we'll talk about some more in a minute about some of the other challenges we've got going into the rest of this year.
Great, because I got a big one I want to ask you about in a second.
Okay, yeah, and you know, we got to talk about the Fed. You know, his. You know, conversation he had on Capitol Hill this week, made some interesting comments, and senators and congressmen said some very interesting things as well. We talk about that, but here's the important thing. July seasonally, now if we go back and look at how do months actually perform, July tends to be a better performing month for the summer. So summer tends to be a weaker period of time because a lot of people are on vacation, there's lighter trading volume and all this type of stuff. August, September tend to be the worst 2 months. And August is when most of Europe goes on vacation. So we lose a lot of support in trading volume as Europe pretty much goes on vacation that entire month. So again, I wouldn't be surprised. Markets are oversold here. We're due really. And if you go back and kind of look at this market this year, we had a very nice bear market rally back in March. It was about an 11% rally. Very nice. We're kind of due for that type of a rally. We need a rally. And here's the thing is that we need a rally that reverses some of the sentiment in the market. Everybody's bearish. Everybody's expecting the market to end, you know, in a terrible fiery crash and we're all be dashed against the rocks and everything's going to get evaporated. There's too much negative sentiment in the markets. We've talked about this before. And you take a look at Google searches for recession, right? It's just off the chart right now. You know, we need enough of a rally that starts to get people back in that bullish camp. We need to see Jim Cramer on CNBC saying, hey, the bottom's in. You got to be buying stocks. You know, go buy these stocks that were all beat up. We need more of that attitude. And we don't have that just yet. There's still too many people predicting a recession, predicting a bear market. And as Bob Farrell once said, you know, rule number 9 of Bob Farrell is that when all experts agree, something else is bound to happen. That's a very true statement from a contrarian sense. So I'm kind of hoping that we get a really strong rally in July to help pull some of these bearish people back into the bullish camp. And that'll give you a really good opportunity to rebalance your portfolio. Because again, I don't think we're at the bear market bottom just yet. we've got a lot of work to do. And primarily one of those big things comes into earnings, but we'll get to that in a minute.
All right. And I just want to sort of elaborate for people what you're saying to make sure they follow. Lance is saying that he doesn't think the bear market in its totality is over yet. And the reason why he says we need to see more bullishness come in is because that's a classic hallmark of a bear market, is it has these periodic rallies where it basically breaks the pessimists who are sitting on the sidelines and convinces them they have to jump back in because the market's about to take off to the races. And then as soon as they do, it does a rug pull moment and just dashes their hopes and then goes even lower, right? That's kind of a hallmark of a bear market here. So that's sort of what you're saying, Lance, right?
Well, no, it is. And if you think about a bear market, you know, and when you talk about it, we wrote an article previously called The Revenant. You know, bears are really bad about just kind of mauling you. And that's what bears do, is they kind of lure you in and they just maul you really badly. And, right. and then they come back. And they do it again. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of way this market, I think, is going to play out. And again, look, there's a lot of things that I could be wrong about, because we're all trying to predict the future. And that's and any prediction more than about, I'm pretty good. And I can pretty much tell you about a week in advance. I can say, look, next week we should have a rally, and I can get that right more often than not. Or, you know, we're probably going to get a sell-off next week, because real short-term analysis, technicals tell you a whole lot. You can predict to a reasonable degree, 70-80% of the time, you can pretty much get pretty close to accuracy on kind of what markets will do. But once you get more than about 3 or 5 days out, anything can happen. The Fed could change course. All of a sudden, you could have something happen out of government. You could have something change in the economy. I mean, just there's too many variables in the stock market that makes longer term predictions, you know, valuable at all. So, you know, what we can rely on is we can go back and look at history and say, this is what normally happens in a bear market. But Adam, you know, there's one big difference in this market and in this bear market that we haven't had in previous bear markets. We don't have real price discovery. We don't have real fair capitalist markets. And what I mean by that is, like, this rally on Friday, very big rally on Friday, market's up 2.5%, great rally from an oversold condition, all predicated upon the Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index came out showing a drop in inflation expectations. All of a sudden, Fed expectations for rate hikes and, you know, past the end of this year just went to zero. So all of a sudden, everybody's predicting the Fed's going to quit hiking rates and we're going to go back to QE. And here's the ringing of Pavlov's bell. And everybody's is like, oh, I better buy stocks now because this is the bottom of the market. You know, we're not there yet. They're still hiking rates. They're still doing QT. That's still taking liquidity out of the markets for right now. They're going to break something eventually. Just don't know when or where or how soon. And that's, but when they do that, that's when we'll see the bottom. But a lot of people are going to get lured in before then. And that's the tough part. They'll get lured in just in time for them to break something.
Yep. And again, that's a big reason why we do this every week, is to try to keep people aware of what's going on to minimize the odds of somebody jumping in it right at the wrong moment. Okay. So, you know, interesting about the sentiment, the inflation expectations amongst consumers. That is a perhaps slightly leading signal of what you and I have been talking about for a long time, Lance, where we think that the reported CPI number is going to moderate lower over the rest of the year, right? We had this whole, is it peaking or not? And we were kind of proven wrong in the sense that it did go up by 0.1%. But in the spirit of what we said, we may still be right, but we need more time to prove us out here. But anyways, that is a new bit of evidence that says, hey, the next numbers being reported here might actually start going down, but we will see. We're not claiming victory yet. All right. So here's a potential reason why the bear could return and maul folks in the relatively near future. I had two really good discussions, actually three really great discussions over the past week. First with Stephanie Pomboy, then with Peter Buchvar, and then with Luke Groman. And folks, all those interviews are up recently on Wealthion. If you haven't watched them, you can go there. I'm going to put up a link to the Peter Buchvar one here, because we talked specifically in that one about margin compression. Right, which is as we are seeing demand begin to slow, and that's exactly what the Fed is out there trying to accomplish. It's also what high prices just do, right? The higher prices go, the more and more people decide, okay, I just can't buy as much, can't afford as much. So we have those twin forces really pulling down demand. We also have a rising cost of capital, which eats into the cash flows of companies and reduces what they're able to do. So we are likely to see lower profitability going forward. And Lance, you have written in the past articles about an earnings recession that may be coming in the future here. But what's interesting, we've talked about this a little bit on this program already. If you look at analysts' forward earnings estimates, they are still extremely rosy. And I think I'm being kind using those words. I think on average, S&P earnings are projected at this point still to be 10% higher next year. And when you look at just the slowing economic growth, the fact that the economy's been in contraction for the first half of this year, when you look at how inflation is just eroding the profit margins, those forces I talked about earlier, it seems extremely likely that most companies are in just a couple of weeks when they start reporting Q2 earnings are going to say, look, it hit our profit margins. We made less than we thought we were going to make. And then B, they're going to have to revise down their earnings projections, their forward projections. And that's going to force the analysts to start having to bring their projections down. Right. And stocks are priced as a function of the projected outlook for earnings. So as those earnings outlooks go down, just mathematically, their stock price forecasts have to go down.
Okay, stop right there, because you just hit on a super important point. So if you take, and what you're talking about here is forward valuations, right? Forward PE ratios. So price divided by earnings, that's how you get to your valuation ratio. Now, what you're talking about here is a very critical point. Right now, you're seeing I've seen a lot of analysts come out lately saying, hey, forward PEs are down to where they were in 2019. They're 15 times earnings. We've done a huge reversal valuation. So stocks are getting cheap here. That is really not true, because the only thing that's come down right now is the P in the PE. So we've had this P compression, but the E, to your point, Adam, has not come down yet. And so when those earnings start to come down, and this is going to be a big issue, and everything you just said is absolutely right. There's going to be margin compression, higher oil prices, higher wages, all that's feeding in to these companies. And now, because of the contraction and spending, companies aren't going to be able to pass on that cost like they were previously when everybody had an extra $1,500 stimulus check, right? So now all of a sudden, this is going to start to impact those margins. So that E has to come down. As the E comes down, if price, and this is the way math works, unfortunately, if price stays flat and E comes down, valuations go up. So in order to get valuations down, price has got to continue to fall to justify for lower earnings. So the earnings have not been accounted for fully by the price decline that we've had up to this point. So there's still downside to the market just to get valuations to realign. So sorry to interrupt, but that was a super important point.
That was exactly actually the response I was hoping you were going to give. So that's great. So short question for you is, how material a factor do you think this is going to be in terms of kind of being one of the next legs that's going to bring the bear back for another mauling, where we're just going to have to go back and reduce forward earnings projections, which is then going to have to bring those valuations down?
Yeah. So if you take a look at the Philly Fed index that just came out this week, right? It came in at -3.3. Now you go, well, what does that have to do with anything? There's a very, and for whatever reason you want to do, and we track a lot of indexes. You can take a look at ISM manufacturing index, take a look at the Philly Fed. We run an economic composite that has more than 100 data points in it that says the same thing. You can take a look at the 6-month rate of change in the leading economic index, tells you the same thing. All of those are telling you that we're having a very sharp contraction in the economy right now. And every one of those indexes, no matter how you line it up, if you overlay that with the rate of change in earnings estimates have not accounted for that drop in economic growth yet. So that has to come. And again, to your point, Adam, what S&P estimates have come down about 4% from where they were earlier this year. I track these things every month. So they've come down about 4%. During an average recession, earnings tend to fall anywhere from 12 to 15 to 18%. So we've got a long ways to go to bring those earnings estimates down to align for slower economic growth, not even accounting for a recession. So if you got to factor in a recession here, that number gets even worse. So when we start looking at the differential between where earnings are currently at on the year-over-year rate of change basis and all these other economic indicators, that gap will close because that correlation exists going all the way back in time, right, to the beginning of these indexes. And it makes complete sense because earnings, where do earnings come from? Earnings come from you and me going to the gas station to fill up our gas tank. That's because that's retail sales. That's the retail store making a revenue growth for selling gas and food and everything else. Going to the grocery store, buying stuff, TVs, whatever. What we do as consumers, 70% of GDP is consumption. That's where earnings come from. Earnings just don't magically show up out of from just thin air. It all comes from consumption. So if consumption slows, earnings have to slow, and the analysts have not factored in a much weaker economic economy. And here's why. Ian Shepherdin just said yesterday that the economy is going to be just fine because consumers are flush with cash. There's very high levels of savings in households, and everything's just fine. The economy is very strong, and everybody's got a job. That is so wrong on so many levels, and this is going to be a terrible outcome for Ian's forecast, is that if you take a look at household savings, he is right. There is a higher level of household savings now than there was previously, but it's in the top 10% of income earners, not the bottom 90% that actually live paycheck to paycheck. They don't have any savings. So when inflation goes up, and we're seeing this already with credit card debt, and it has been rising sharply, interest rates on credit card payments are going up sharply, which means more disposable income goes to paying a credit card payment versus buying stuff. Consumers are already having to contract. We talked about retail sales last week here on the show. That contraction in retail sales is much larger than it seems because retail sales are measured in dollars, not volume. And because of inflation, the drop in volume of purchases was much greater than even what retail sales showed. All that's going to feed into earnings for these companies, Walmart, Target, Amazon, all talking about too much inventory. You need to go buy new furniture for your deck. The summer is going to be the time to do it. All that stuff's going on sale. So you're going to have the opportunity to buy a lot of stuff cheaper. And this is also going to feed into that inflation story, you know, later this year. But, you know, the consumer is not ready for recession. They're not prepared for a recession. And what's going to cause the recession is going to be the contraction of that consumption when the ability to buy hits that wall, and that's coming sooner rather than later.
Okay, great. So great answer. Just a quick summary of it to my question of how big of a deal do you think this is going to be? It sounds like you're saying it's going to be a big deal. It's going to be a big deal when they report it in a couple of weeks, Q2 with the outlook, and then it's going to continue to be a big deal as we see the further demand destruction where the consumer increasingly is tapping out, right? I see you nodding as I say this. Okay, so this is taking the conversation right where I want to go. I'm going to go through kind of the success that the Fed is having right now in bringing demand destruction down, and then we'll get to talking about the Fed specifically. And I'll hand the baton back to you to talk about, you know, some of the things the Fed and people on Capitol Hill said this week. So again, you know, Powell has been, Fed Chair Jerome Powell has been, he's minced no words in saying, my job, I can't control the supply side of things, so I'm going after demand. I'm declaring war on demand. And to do that, he's just basically trying to make things so expensive that consumers can buy less. And they just, they take the pressure off the buying pressure that's been contributing to driving prices up. So you just talked about how unprepared the consumer household is for recession. And I've been doing periodic videos on this, but here's some stats I just pulled today. It's a recent Bankrate survey. I'm just going to read this. Some 63% of US households have recently cut back on consumer spending, while 57% spend less on groceries and 44% are reducing gas expenditures. About 35% are making fewer debt payments, which can put people even further into debt. And this one was really scary. About 58% are uncomfortable with the amount of money they have in their savings, That's up dramatically from last year. And here's the big one. Of those who responded that they were uncomfortable with their emergency fund, 75% said they had no savings or not enough to cover at least 3 months worth of living expenses. Right.
But, so that's but Ian Shepherdin said everybody's fine. But to your point, though, that's exactly my point, is that you have to break these numbers down and look at the strata of individuals, you know, break these things down into deciles, who owns what, you know, wealth, income, all that, savings. It's all, you know, no matter what ratio you use, debt to income, saving, household savings rates, it's all heavily skewed by the top 10% of income earners.
Right. And we mentioned this super briefly last week, so it's worth that we're really kind of reinforcing it this week. This is the importance of understanding the difference between mean and median, right? So the median is the person in the middle, right? It's the 50th percentile person. How are they doing, right? Versus the mean or the average, right? And the averages get woefully skewed when you look at economic numbers, because the top 10% own so much of the total wealth that they just skew the average, right? So the on average, it looks like everybody's doing great. In reality, 10% of people are doing great, you know, another 10 are doing okay. And then everybody else is like hanging on by their fingernails or already, you know, below water economically. Okay, so that's the weakness of households, at least the latest snapshot on that. Then we have inventories quickly building up, which you mentioned earlier, right? So Target just came out and said its product inventories were up 43% from the previous year, while Walmart's increased by 32%. I'm showing a headline here that says retail's inventory glut means big business for liquidators, right? So like you said, Lance, this is the summer to go buy your patio furniture, right? Exactly. Screaming deals out there.
It's all stuff you don't want, but you know, it's stuff to buy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm putting up a chart here by Wolf Richter. This is the inventory to sales ratio. So this tries to actually show, to your point, Lance, try not to skew it just by the dollar amount, but how is inventory stacking up basically? And you can see here that it is spiking in the past year, right? So no surprise to what we've been talking about here, but we're really just seeing evidence that the consumer is not showing up to buy this stuff anymore, right? And then we're seeing housing continue to cool fast. So I'm just going to put up a quick chart here from a Bloomberg article, which basically is saying, hey, global monetary tightening is squeezing home buyers, adding to risks that a slowdown could ripple through the economy. This chart is showing that we are now seeing just a tremendous amount more of price cuts in all the major sort of hot markets versus a year ago. You know, you see here, like Boise, Idaho at the top here, there's four times the inventory this year that has a price cut versus last year.
Yeah, I've been chuckling all week long. This is how I've been ticking people off on Twitter, is I wrote an article 2 years ago saying that there is no such thing as a housing shortage. And all right. of a sudden we've got just tons of inventory sitting around, because it's always about supply and demand. And you know what happens in housing is always on the very fringes of those just buying and selling. And all of a sudden there's no buyers. And all of a sudden there's plenty of inventory, and to find a buyer, it just, you know, when you have excess inventory at Target, what do? Put it on sale. If you have an excess inventory of housing and you want to get it sold, you have to put it on sale. So, you know, this is becoming a buyer's market pretty quick.
Well, it is. So two things real quick. So one, I'm going to put up a chart here. I just talked about the US market, but we're seeing internationally. Here's a chart of Canada, which has some of the most overvalued or highly valued cities in the entire world. This is showing that Canada's largest city, Toronto, prices are down almost 9% since just February alone, right? So what is that? That's 4-ish, 5 months, already down almost 9%. What I want to say about kind of the housing market in general, but also your specific prediction there about inventory, Lance, is I think you're completely right. I think you're beginning to be validated on that point, but I think we are so early in this. I mean, I think we're in the first inning, and I don't even think the teams have switched sides yet, right? So, you know, I think you're going to have plenty of fodder to say, hey, look, this is exactly what I was talking about, folks. If you think you've got validation now, I think you're going to have a truckload later on. Okay, so real quick, just a couple more stats, and I'll hand it back to you. Here is a chart here of revocations of trucking authority. And basically what this is this is a chart put out by a company called FreightWaves that tracks the trucking shipping industry. This is from an article of theirs called "A Great Purge is Pushing Small Truckers Out of Business at an Unprecedented Rate." And this is just basically showing that, as tends to happen when supply chains get really tight, is you have there's a shortage, a bunch of people show up to try to fill the shortage, and very quickly you go from a paucity to a glut as things begin to equilibrate. And that's exactly what's happening with the flow of retail goods here. And you know, it looked like, you know, beginning of this year, there was no way that we were ever going to catch up to these snarled supply chains. We're now beginning to get on top of it. And you're basically seeing this just total wipeout of the newer and smaller players here in the trucking industry, as people realize there's just not enough shipments to be able to, you know, let a lot of these guys afford to stay on the road. So we got that going on too. These are just all evidence of demand destruction, which you and I have been waving our hands for a while, Lance, and just to give us a little bit of a pat in the back. Yeah. We were doing it when a lot of people really didn't feel they could imagine that, given how hot inflation had been, right? Lastly, I just want to do a couple of real world stories here. One, I'm going to put up an image here. I've shown it once or twice before. Give full credit, Elon Musk tweeted this out. But it's a picture of a 7-Eleven with a gas station next to it. And you see the price of both unleaded gasoline and diesel gasoline are both $7.11. Very kind of karmically coincidental, but just shows that, you know, gas prices are crazy still. I live in Northern California. I live now in the world, apparently, of $20 hamburgers and $20 omelets. You can't get either in my area for less than that at this point in time. I went to a bar last night. It was bar trivia. Some friends invited me, went there. The only place to order was off of a food truck. Those small sort of 12-inch personal pizzas, only thing to order. So I ordered one, and it was like $26. And then when you give tip, it's basically a $30 tiny pizza, right? And so, you know, the average person here, I think, is getting to the point where, I mean, you just can't do that very much with the monthly budget most people have, right, Lance?
Yeah, it is. And this is, you know, again, you know, I've got a whole slew of terrorists in my house that I'd have to take
out. Children, but yes.
They're called children, yes. You know, I call them, I love them. They're my personal Taliban. You know, but you know, we take them out to eat on a regular, you know, every now and then, and you know, spend time together, whatever. And it's really just getting, you know, astronomically expensive and
prohibitively. And that's what demand destruction is, right?
And it really is. And this is the thing that, you know, people forget, and people are going to start making these choices. We're already starting to see people make these decisions not to eat out as much, not to order. You know, this is going to impact companies like Grubhub and, you know, DoorDash and others that depend on deliveries. And, you know, people are going to start making these decisions because, you know, if you go to order off Grubhub, you pay for the food, then you pay for the delivery, and you pay for the Grubhub guy, and you pay the tip. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, meals are getting, you know, to drop $100 on a meal is getting very, very easy to do. And people are going to start making these decisions. But that, to your point, that's that demand destruction that's going to come through the economy. And all this is going to reverse. All the stuff that led up to this problem is going to reverse. And this is the one thing I know it's hard to kind of get your head around in a lot of cases. And for individuals like, oh, well, we can't, you know, oil can only go up from here. You know, we were talking 2 weeks ago about, you know, needing to take profits out of oil prices and, you know, out of oil stocks. And because, you know, oil price very extended, you're going to have a correction. We've had a very nice correction in oil companies. Now there's a potential here. We might see a little bit of a buying opportunity, but you know, there's going to be, you know, all of these excesses in one direction. And you used some words a minute ago, I'm gonna have to go get a dictionary out for, but you know, all these excesses that we had in one direction is now going to your point, it's going to lead to gluts in the other, because as demand falls, you know, that supply is going to continue to build. Good example, talking about oil, right? We're producing 12 million barrels a day in oil. At the peak of production 2020, before we shut down the economy, we're doing 13 million barrels. So we're about a million barrels short on production. Well, as soon as demand falls, if we don't produce, if we just keep producing 12 million barrels a day, we're going to start having oil builds, you know, in supply. And that's just a function of what's going to happen, because supply and demand will rebalance itself at some point. And then, of course, if you do something like open up more production with OPEC, or we resolve the issue with Russia and they are allowed to start, you know, exporting oil again. I thought it was interesting. Joe Biden made the comment this past week. One of his solutions for getting oil gas prices down was to put a buyer cartel together to buy oil from Russia at lower prices. Well, that's going to, yes, that will bring down gas prices, because now you're going to have a supply, you know, have more supply. But the whole point was to punish Russia by not buying their oil, right? So now you want to put a cartel together to buy their oil. So what's more important? You know, but this is, but all this stuff resolves itself. And this is, and as we talked about before, strip out all the political bias, strip out everything else. You know, making one-sided bets is the dangerous thing when it comes to your portfolio. Betting that things can only go in one direction indefinitely always works out very badly. So just understand that all these things will cycle. Inflation is going to come back in. All the inflation trades are going to become losing trades at some point. Now, not today, not tomorrow, not next week, not next month. But eventually, what was working over the last year or two based on the assumption of rising inflation is now going to have changed to what's going to work in a deflationary environment as we get there. But that's going to take time. But this is the problem with one-sided bets, and where investors typically go wrong is they forget to change their bets. They just keep betting in one direction, thinking it's just going to go in one direction forever.
So I would say that is a truism that's true kind of no matter what the markets are doing. But I would say it's especially true right now, because we're in a period where we're kind of lurching from one trajectory to another here, right? So we've gone from years of not enough inflation, you know, if you listen to the Fed, to now way too much inflation. You and I are saying, hey, everybody, you know, demand destruction is the key thing to have your eye on here. We're going to be going into disinflation and have the forces of deflation become a big issue here. But then there also is the specter of a Fed pivot in the mix here too. So we may be going in the same year from like inflation to deflation to then inflation again, right?
Yeah.
So you got to really be paying attention. Of course, that's why we do these weekly updates here. I think it underscores the importance of like having a plan in place, but also working with a advisor who can help you change the plan and adapt it as the macro situation changes, right? In other words, kind of to package what you just said, I think a close your eyes, set it and forget it strategy at this point is extremely dangerous, because even if you're right in predicting the endpoint, you may get killed six or seven times along the way, given the zigs and zags that reality might take here. I see you smiling, so I'll let you comment before I go to the next.
Well, no, it was just interesting because when you were talking about, you know, strategy and that type of stuff, I got a tweet the other day, and it's a person that watches, you know, this channel and watches our recaps every week. And she's like, and she made this comment that, you know, she was a client of mine and, you know, the performance wasn't what we talk about here on the show. And, you know, the problem is that every week she kept changing the strategy. You know, we would start buying, you know, bonds or whatever it was. This is, you know, way earlier. You know, we'd buy bonds and then she'd want to sell those and then go buy something else. Or, you know, and the point about having a strategy is that you've got to commit to letting a strategy work over time. You know, there's not a fix to where you say, I'm going to do this today and that's just going to keep working from now on, because markets change on a very regular basis. And we have to make a decision, say, okay, our outlook is this, and we're making bets today for something that's going to happen 6, 8, 9 months from now. And again, so if I was a betting man today and I said, hey, where, if I had raw capital today, where am I going to invest it? I would be buying long dated treasuries, and I would be buying potentially some growth stocks, and I would be buying everything that's anti-inflationary. Because if you take a look at fund manager surveys right now, they are convinced, the vast majority of fund managers say that energy stocks are going to outperform everything else over the next year. That may be the case, but normally, historically speaking, when every fund manager is long one commodity, that's the time to sell it and buy what they're short the most of. And right now, that's Bitcoin and bonds. So the things they hate the most tend to be the best performing assets over the course of time. But you have to let you have to be willing to commit to a strategy and let it work. Because if you're constantly changing your strategy, it's not going to work. There's just, you're not going to get the result that you wanted to get.
So agreed. And so I kind of split that in two. I would say, absolutely. Like, I think you and I and every financial advisor out there would say, look, having a plan is better than having no plan, right? Having no plan, you get whipsawed by your emotions. We just talked about that, right? So if you would invest in making a plan, you should stick to the plan unless you see data that encourages you to change the plan, and then you should stick to that new plan, right? So that's just the importance of a plan. I would say, a big part of what we do here at Wealthline is encourage people to take this information and make it actionable. But we say for the vast majority of people, myself included, we have real lives. We don't have the bandwidth to be watching the markets on a 24/7 basis. And we also get whipsawed by our own emotions. And so having a great coach, having a good financial advisor who is helping you build a plan, but also helping you stick to it, right? When you decide that I'm getting a little bit nervous, I might want to change the plan. You have somebody to go to and talk about whether that makes sense or not, right? And so where I'm going with this is, if you decide that you're one of the majority of people in my mind that should be working with an advisor, pick an advisor whose judgment you trust, and then trust them. Meaning, like, don't do what you just said, Lance. Don't be saying, oh, well, my advisor told me to do X, but my gut's telling me to do Y, so I'm going to go against my advisor. Because then you don't have a plan. Right. Yeah. You've gone through the steps of working with a good person to come up with a good plan, and then you're kind of tossing it out the window. So I would say don't work with an advisor if you don't feel like you can do that. If you can't, go on your own, because if you don't, you're going to have a bad outcome. You're going to waste their time. They're going to be frustrated, and they're going to feel, you're doing a disservice to them because they want to help you, but you're not listening. Right. So decide whether or not you're going to stick to a plan. If so, great, stick to it. And if you're going to work with an advisor, great. Put all your upfront effort into identifying a good one that you're going to trust, but then trust them.
Yeah. And, work with them. And, I encourage, our worst clients are the ones that don't communicate. We have one that I always get clients that come in and they're like, I'm not going to bother you, right? I'm going to trust you. I'm going to let you do what you want to do. And I'm not ever going to bother you. I'm like, I really don't want you for a client then. And they're like, what do you mean? I said, if you don't communicate with me, we're having this meeting right now and we're saying, okay, this is what I'm going to do for you. Here's the strategy. But if you don't communicate with me about what you're feeling and how you feel and what's bothering you and what's not bothering you, I can adjust strategy to accommodate for your emotional bias to help you weather that, because not everybody's meant to be an aggressive investor or a conservative investor or whatever. We can make those adjustments. But part of the process of building a relationship with any advisor is having that understanding so that the advisor understands what your real goals are. Look, people take these questionnaires all the time. They say, I took this questionnaire. I'm a super aggressive investor. Or I'm super conservative, whatever. And those are terrible. They never really reflect people's values. And I have people tell me all the time, it's like, oh, I can just buy and hold stocks. I'm good. Just buy stocks and let them ride. As soon as the market tanks 2%, they're like, get me out. And those are those things that, through communication, have that communication with your advisor, talk to them, let them know how you feel. And one thing I tell my clients all the time is, look, if something's bothering you, call me. I will take it out of your portfolio. We'll fix it right there. And then we'll come back to it later. And over time, I learn how you think, and then I can help tailor the portfolio to fit your personality rather than trying to force you to fit the portfolio, which never works out. And that's what leads to these people making these decisions. I'm in, I'm out. I don't like this. I want that. And, I have clients that are calling up and like, I think, the president's going to tank the country. I want to be all in gold, whatever. And it's like, whoa, just, none of this stuff has anything to do with how markets work. Let's just focus on what make markets work, and invest that way and leave your personal biases at the door. But that's a very tough and challenging thing to do. But the point is, and to your point is, communicate, work with your advisor. There's a lot of great advisors out there. The biggest reason that people have challenges with advisors is because A, they don't trust them. B, then there's not a relationship between you and the advisor. And C is that there's a mismatch between what you told the advisor you wanted versus what you really emotionally are prepared to have. And that's the biggest factor.
All right. Great, great points. And I do want to pivot off this and get to the Fed in just a second, but yeah. We're now back in the territory we were, I think, 2 weeks ago, where we talked about sort of the importance of, mindset around money and the importance in a financial advisory relationship of, you know, where it's almost more, it's like part therapist, yeah. Right? And my wife, who is a therapist, listened to that and totally agreed with everything. And like in her line of work, almost every issue does come down in some way, shape, or form to a breakdown in communication, right? Yeah. So it's the same thing you're saying. And I'll give you some props, Lance, too. She did listen to it. She said, oh, this is pretty good, actually, for a guy that hasn't, you know, gone through an advanced degree in therapy.
I spent years in therapy. So,
no, but I mean, you spent decades talking with real people. Yeah. You've learned, you know, by the school of hard knocks. All right. So let's get back to the Fed for just a moment. I want to talk about a couple of issues, Fed pivot, quantitative tightening, et cetera. But why don't I let you set the stage in terms of what's happened over the past week, just in terms of Fed-related news. You talked about Powell saying some things, as well as a few folks on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, so first of all, this is going to duplicate as our rant for the week as well. I think it's probably going to...
Okay. Just so you know, I have one already noted down here too, so we might get two rants this week.
That, or you may have to save one for next week. So this week, Jerome Powell was doing testimony before both Senate and Congress and talking about Fed policy, what their outlook was. And of course, that opens up the door for, you know, senators and congressmen to ask questions of Jerome Powell. What was interesting, of course, is that Jerome Powell said, he opened the door. He said, look, our goal is not to create a recession. That's not what we want to do. We want to try to bring down inflation. And we think the economy is strong enough. We think employment is strong enough to help that they can weather higher interest rates. But we're not ruling out that a recession is possible. Look, I don't, you know, he's working off of lagging data. There is enough data on a real-time basis, whether you look at the Atlanta Fed GDP now, or you look at the Philly Fed manufacturing indexes or consumer sentiment indexes. And I wrote an article last week about the National Federation of Independent Business. That gauge, that measure from the NFIB is one of the best indicators of recession. And they're ringing alarm bells across the board that a recession is coming. I don't see how you avoid having a recession here. I'm not saying it's entirely impossible, though. There's, you know, nothing is inevitable. When I was on Charles Payne on Friday, yesterday, he said, well, it's inevitable that we're going to have a recession. I said, look, there's only three things that are inevitable in this world. That's death, taxes, and Thanos. And, you know, outside of that, everything is got a possibility. So is it possible we could avoid a recession? Yes, it's possible. I think it's probable we're going to have a recession, and I think we need to be aware of that from a variety of standpoints. But what was really disheartening, and look, you have to understand that a lot of what happens in Congress and Senate is political theater, and I'm hoping that this is more theater than reality, because some of the questions that were coming from the people running our country was absolutely horrifying as to how uneducated, if these were true questions and not political theater, and again, hoping it's political theater, it suggests that the people running our country have absolutely no understanding of the basics of economics. And mind you, these are the people sitting on the board of the Senate Banking Committee, as an example. They're supposed to be the ones overseeing the banks and don't have a basic understanding of supply and demand, economics 101, why we have inflation now, what was the cause of inflation. And as a good example of this, you know, Jerome Powell was asked, you know, by Elizabeth Warren. She goes, do you realize that you hiking rates is going to cause people to lose their jobs, and it's going to have, you know, it's going to cause these people misery? Yeah, Elizabeth, that's what economies do. You have an expansion in the economy, and then you have a recession, and that gets rid of the excesses built up during the expansion. That's the whole purpose of an economic cycle. And nobody can repeal that economic cycle. So yes, hiking rates, some people are going to lose their job. Jerome Powell answering that question says, hey, look, you know, we've got an imbalance between job openings and the number of people we have working. You know, so to fix that imbalance, we're going to have to slow the economy down. Some people are going to have to lose their jobs. You know, we're probably talking about unemployment going to 5%, at least 6%, to try to balance some of the economic structure. That's going to create a recession. But this is just part of the economic cycle. This is how things work. And the mistake that we've made, and again, this is why I told you it was a rant. The mistake we have made is by trying to prolong economic cycles in the first place.
Right. I would even say do away with the cycles we don't like versus prolong. I mean, we've really tried to just make it an eternal boom, right?
Yeah.
Which just makes the inevitable bust that much bigger, right?
Right. You know, and we've talked about wildfires in California, and you know, one of the things that have led to so many major fires in California has been the lack of forest management. You know, you've got it. You know, fires are actually a healthy thing. It makes the forest stronger over time, makes them healthier by getting rid of the dead wood and the brush and everything else. You know, that's what recessions do. Recessions are actually cleansing. I know we don't like them, but if we allow them to occur on a regular basis instead of trying to prolong these things, A, the bust wouldn't be so bad. You know, you wouldn't have such a detrimental outcome to the economy, and you'd have better equality of wealth in the economy by right. doing that.
And you'd have stronger, more robust businesses.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, look, the reason there's a direct correlation between all these Fed interventions and the rise of wealth in the top 10% of income earners that have assets to invest.
Direct result. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I was trying to be nice.
I know. Well, so now we're in full rant mode, right? Where, I mean, right. that is my number one beef with the Fed, and I've got many, but at the end of the day, it is the tremendous, accelerating, and horribly unfair disparity of wealth that its policies create. And I think I don't want to get too distracted on this, but you can point to many different social issues that I think at the end of the day, kind of their root cause is economic injustice. That's really a driving factor in those. And so there's a lot of things that if you care about racial inequality, if you care about, you know, homelessness, if you care about, I mean, a whole bunch of factors, really at the end of the day, you can say, you know what, if we just right-size Fed policy, that would probably be the single biggest thing we could do to help all of those different constituencies.
Adam, it's a true point. People don't riot in the streets if they're happy at home. Right. If you've got a job, you're raising your family. Oh, look, at the end of the day, what do we all want? Right. We want to get up. We want to go to work. We want to feel like we're all treated fairly. We want to come home, raise our kids and be happy. And this is why I think so many people are like, just leave me alone. Right. And just leave me alone. Let me live my life. And if we had a better equality of economics, which we would have if we would just let capitalism work like it's supposed to, then you wouldn't have, to your point, you wouldn't have these people rioting in the streets. You wouldn't have all this distress and unrest in the economy, because if people are generally happy, everything else really isn't that big of a deal.
Yeah. So I'm gonna put up a quick video here. We used to use a lot at the company I used to run before I founded Wealthion. But it's a research science experiment showing how animals, you know, of which humans are part of the animal kingdom, are just innately wired for injustice. So I'm going to play that video clip right now.
So a final experiment that I want to mention to you is our fairness study. And so this became a very famous study, and there's now many more, because after we did this about 10 years ago, it became very well known. And we did that originally with capuchin monkeys. And I'm going to show you the first experiment that we did. It has now been done with dogs and with birds and with chimpanzees, but with Sarah Brosnan, we started out with capuchin monkeys. So what we did is we put two capuchin monkeys side by side. Again, these animals, they live in a group. They know each other. We take them out of the group, put them in a test chamber. And there's a very simple task that they need to do. And if you give both of them cucumber for the task, the two monkeys side by side, they're perfectly willing to do this 25 times in a row. So cucumber, even though it's really only water in my opinion, but cucumber is perfectly fine for them. Now, if you give the partner grapes, the food preferences of my capuchin monkeys correspond exactly with the prices in the supermarket. And so if you give them grapes, that's a far better food, then you create inequity between them. So that's the experiment we did. Recently, we videotaped it with new monkeys who had never done the task, thinking that maybe they would have a stronger reaction, and that turned out to be right. The one on the left is the monkey who gets cucumber. The one on the right is the one who gets grapes. The one who gets cucumber, note that the first piece of cucumber is perfectly fine. The first piece he eats. Then she sees the other one getting grape, and you will see what happens. So she gives a rock to us. That's the task. And we give her a piece of cucumber, and she eats it. The other one needs to give a rock to us. And that's what she does. And she gets a grape. And she eats it. The other one sees that. She gives a rock to us now, gets again cucumber. She tests a rock now against the wall. She needs to give it to us. And she gets cucumber again. So this is basically the Wall Street protest that you see here.
All right, Lance. So you can see here, like, essentially what the Fed is doing is it is giving, you know, an increasingly small number of people, you know, just a single digit percentage wise, all the grapes, while the rest of us are getting cucumbers and increasingly just getting, you know, irate about anything because we're so pissed off, quite frankly, about all the injustice that we're suffering here. All right, look, so I hate to say it. I think it's probably not just all kabuki theater, meaning we've talked about how pensions, a lot of times pension boards, let's say like for a teacher's union, there's a lot of teachers on there or policemen for a policeman's union or whatnot, who are on the board. And it's like a five-person board. And many of these guys have absolutely zero experience, you know, investing capital, right? And all of a sudden they're making capital allocation decisions on a multi-billion dollar portfolio here, right? They just don't have the understanding, the experience. And you can understand kind of the heartfelt reason why we want some policemen on the board of our own pension, right? But they just don't have the skills, right? It's the exact same thing happens in politics, right?
Right.
The popular people get elected, but they may have absolutely zero clue. And I would say most politicians, from my personal cheap seats view, they really don't have, I would even consider, a basic understanding of sort of how just the fundamentals of economics work, and certainly not a good understanding of how our monetary system works. And one thing, and this is the rant I was going to introduce later, so I'll just inject it now because it's related. So what's the big thing that's been going on between the administration and the oil industry recently, right? It's the administration's been saying, guys, gas prices are way too high. You got to bring gas prices down, right? And there's been this back and forth between the White House and the oil industry execs, where guys are, you know, writing their white papers, and, you know, Biden saying these guys are taking advantage of us, and, you know, administration's been threatening to put a profits windfall tax on these guys, and of course the oil industry is saying, hey, here are all the things you could do to enable us to bring prices down, but we need guarantees from you because we're not going to make all this, you know, infrastructure allocations unless we know we're going to have the time back to recoup this stuff. So it's been this, you know, cluster going back and forth.
Yeah.
So one of the proposals this week from the administration was to send everybody gas cards that had, like, you know, balances on them that you could go use to buy gas, right? It's basically a subsidy to help you buy gas, right? It's basically more stimulus, right? It's the exact same thing that created the high prices that we have right now, right? And it's like, what are you talking? Are you kidding me? If you're trying to get this down, why are you pouring more gasoline on the fire you're trying to put out here?
No pun intended.
So exactly. But I mean, but that's kind of one of those, like, you know, Zoolander, am I taking crazy pill moments, right?
Well, this is my point, though. They are convinced, you know, and again, this may be kabuki theater. I kind of think it's not. They are convinced that the trillions of dollars worth of stimulus had nothing to do with the inflation that we have now. It's like, oh, that's completely fine. We did all that stimulus. You know, this is all Russia or whatever, right? There's a thousand other reasons why we have inflation. No, you know, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And when you send people money or give them gas cards with money on it, they're going to go out and spend it. That's what people do. If they actually save money like they should, then we wouldn't have a problem, right? We send everybody $15 checks. They put it in savings for their retirement. and we would not have inflation now, right? Because of that. But they don't do that. You send them money, they're going to spend it, because that's what, that's why people, you just read the stats, you know, just a minute ago, how many people have money, how many people live in paycheck to paycheck, credit card debt, all this type of stuff. That's the whole problem that we have. And so these solutions that come out of Washington are so asinine, because they're completely devoid of economic and, you know, just basic economic analysis of, if we do A, what's the consequence of this action? And we never look at that. We just want to do things that make us feel better and hopefully get us votes come up midterm election. That's all this is about. Nobody looks at the consequences of those actions.
Well, absolutely. All right, look, I want to keep ranting with you, but I got a few more things on the checklist to bang through here. So back to the Fed for a moment. So had a really good interview with Luke Groman, which I'm going to put a link up to here. If you haven't seen it, folks, that'd be a great one to watch after this video, if you haven't watched it yet, where Luke basically said, like you, Lance, he believes that the Fed is not going to be able to hike as much as it has said. It's going to break something beforehand, and it's going to be just forced to go back to easing. He said he thinks it's going to pivot by the end of Q3, or has been thinking that, but he said, I think the smart money is on the under for that. So, you know, we start Q3 next week, right? Yeah. So it's not very far away, right? So he's basically saying September or sooner, which is pretty darn close here. So I guess first question I have for you is just gut feel. Are you kind of on the same timeline in terms of when you think the Fed will pivot?
So two things. One, so we were talking about a moment ago about how earnings had not been factored in yet for where the economy is going, right? So if you take a look at the economy and what's happening with the economy, earnings haven't factored that in yet. Bond or interest rates, right? Bond prices inverted or interest rates currently have not factored in where the economy is going. And so as we see this contraction in economic growth, yields are way too high compared to where economic growth is going to be. So yields are going to have to fall sharply over the course of the next 3, 6, 9 months. And that's going to all occur with this economic slowdown. Now, that'll be exacerbated by the Fed tightening their balance sheet, by the Fed trying to hike interest rates. And I don't have the Luke is probably a lot smarter. Well, Luke is smarter than I am. So he's probably got a better handle on this than I do. I don't know whether it's Q3 or Q4, but I do suspect sometime between the beginning of July and the end of this year, the Fed is going to be reversing course, not because they've got inflation under control, but because they broke something in the economy and financial. And regardless of what people think, you know, the Fed's up on Capitol Hill going, we're committed to our battle of inflation. We're committed to that fight. That's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge statement, because they're only committed to that fight because they know that they've got to worry about financial instability. Inflation is going to take care of itself. If the Fed did nothing, inflation is going to come down because of demand destruction. So the Fed doesn't have to do anything. The Fed doesn't have to hike rates in order to bring inflation down. That's going to occur all by itself. Why is the Fed hiking rates when they know that you're headed towards a recession? They don't have to look very hard to see the economic data. So why are they hiking rates? The real reason they're hiking rates is they're just praying to God they've got enough time to get off of zero and get interest rates to 2.25, 2.5, 2.75 before the next recession hits. So they have some room for the only policy tool that works in combating inflation. QE does not, combating a recession. QE does not fix economic growth. All that does is boost asset prices, and you hope that you get some consumer sentiment pick up there and that consumers go out and buy stuff, that'll help the economy grow. But the only thing that really works is dropping rates. Their biggest fear is they get caught at zero when the recession hits and they've got no tool whatsoever. That's the big fear for the Fed.
Yeah. And you know, we use the term cost of capital. I don't know if we've really delved into that enough for folks, because it is what you're basically saying right there is that cost of capital is really all that matters in terms of any Absolutely. Ability the Fed has to sort of, you know, change destiny. We'll have to earmark that for perhaps next week, just because we need to give it the attention it deserves. All right. So getting back to Luke for a second. So like you said, you know, he thinks it's going to pivot. He does not think inflation is going to be solved by then, right? And so if the Fed does pivot, we basically get a resurgence in inflation, right? And the potential that credit yields could continue rising, because, and this is a Bill Fleckenstein prediction, but if the Fed pivots without bringing inflation under control, Bill thinks that that's when it really loses the bond market. When the bond market says, all right, you guys are proving you're clowns. You don't have the ability to tame inflation here. And we want to be compensated for the additional risk going forward to capital, right?
I'm, again, those guys, both of them, a lot smarter than I am. I would take the other side of that argument from this standpoint only, is that when the Fed pivots, they're going to be combating an economic or financial crisis of some sort. And that's going to force money out of equities into bonds for safety. Again, treasuries.
That's going to force money into long-dated U.S. treasuries.
Correct. And I was just about to clarify that, yeah, in that environment, you don't want to be in corporate bonds, high yield bonds, muni bonds.
Right. There's lots of other bonds that aren't treasuries. Yeah,
exactly. All those yields are going to spike. So they are going to lose control of that end of the bond market. Long dated U.S. treasuries will be the safe haven. So right. I just think it deserves, again, Bill Fleckenstein is right that when the Fed pivots, they're going to lose control of that long of that longer end of the bond market that is non-treasury related, because that's what happens in there. Go back and look at credit spreads of all different types of bonds back in 2008. They were all running, yields were surging, 10-year treasury rates were falling like a rock. They run in opposite directions because it's a safe haven play. So that would be my only argument, just to clarify between what type of bonds we're talking about.
Yeah, great. And it's good you did, because we won't go into it in depth, but that's why you have the TLT position that you've been building up, is an expectation of that. So the reason why I'm kind of emphasizing this so much is I want to make sure that people aren't thinking, okay, Fed pivot means we just go back to the world that we had 2010 through, you know, 2019, right?
Pavlov's about to ring the bell, right?
Yeah, but it's a different world, right? Inflation's a lot hotter right now, and we had the bond market support back then. So we may have neither in this new world. So the thing I'm trying to underscore, and I think one of the titles of one of the videos of the interviews I did with Luke was like, you know, everything changes in Q3. And I don't know, will absolutely everything change? Who knows? But my point is if the Fed does pivot, it should be a brand new chapter here, right? That's not going to look like the period before, not looking like the period now. It's going to look like something very different. And honestly, I think it's going to look a lot more complicated.
I agree with the complication part. I really have no idea what it's going to look like. What I do know, right, or what I think I know at the moment is that we've got too many people, and this is why we're talking about why the bear market's not over yet. There are too many people right now watching the Fed too closely, looking for that pivot so they can run in and buy junk stocks again.
Right.
Right. And they're going, well, that's what
Fed puts back on. I'm all in. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. And that is, and I'm not saying that's not going to be the case, because I think, you know, there's going to be an initial surge of capital. Just, you know, it's like as soon as they say, hey, we're done hiking rates.
That's Pavlov's dog.
Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, this market's going to scream at least short term. And then everybody's going to figure out what the hell's happening. So I think that what you're definitely going to have to deal with, whether the future is different than the past, same as the past, I don't know. We spent 12 years training people, like, and again, I mentioned Pavlov's dogs, right? We've been ringing that bell every time the market corrects for the last 12 years. And now there's a whole generation of people. That's all they know. And there's a whole generation, by the way, of money managers that started post 2009. There's a lot of people out there blogging right now and writing articles and, you know, very popular guys on CNBC that, you know, were in diapers basically when we were going through the financial crisis, and their first investing experience was 2015, 2016. So all they've seen is this market cycle of buy the dips. And we haven't killed that buy the dip mentality yet. It's not gone. As I said, I'm getting too many emails going, hey, is it time yet? Is it time yet? Is it time yet? Every time we have a dip, is it time yet? No, it's not time yet. But that buy the dip mentality, and I mean, you know, people are just salivating, waiting for that bell to ring.
Right, right. And that's obviously part of the danger of, hey, that's how we know that bear market's not over, which is what you're saying. But kind of just to go back to what I'm saying and murdering the Pavlov analogy here is they've been conditioned for over a decade of, we ring the bell, you get a treat, right? In terms of higher stock prices. Well, we may ring the bell and they may show up and salivate, but instead of getting a treat, they might get nothing. They might get punched in the mouth, right?
It's just cucumbers.
Yeah, it might get cucumbers, right? And that's what I'm saying is we should not expect that it's just going to be like the show that we've gotten used to seeing, right?
Yeah, no, and that was my point, is we're just going to have to navigate for what comes, understand the dynamics, you know, trade accordingly, and manage risk. And look, what works in a bear market works in a bull market. You know, and you know, you're not going to get all the upside. And this is the mistake that investors make is, you know, I got to beat this phantom benchmark index, right? I got to beat the S&P or I've got to beat the NASDAQ. Investing is not a competition. There's no prizes for winning, but there's a hell of a penalty for losing. So, you know, just treat investing for what it is. And that the purpose of investing is to grow our capital at a rate that outpaces inflation over time, over a long period of time. So take your average inflation rate. That's your goal of investing, is to outpace that average inflation rate to make sure your savings are keeping up with your cost of living adjustments over time. Trying to build wealth in the market requires speculation, and that requires taking on more risk. And as long as you're comfortable with the excess risk, that's okay. But along with that excess risk comes the potential for greater losses. So, you know, there's no free lunch.
There's no free lunch. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well said. All right. Look, real quick, I want to actually, I've got a sort of a positive theme I'm looking to end on here, but real quick, trades for the week. Did you guys make any notable trades this week?
Big goose egg this week. Okay. Did nothing.
Just because you're sticking to your plan, right?
Well, what we did last week was, so not this week, but the previous week, we took off our short hedge at near the market lows, and we reduced our short position against the market. And we want to allow the market to rally here. And if the market gets back to oversold, we're comfortable with our equity positions right now. We're about 30% exposed to equities. Got a big heavy slug of cash. We've got our 10-year. We've got our position size in TLT. We're going to add to that eventually. We're looking for that opportunity, getting very close to a buy signal, long-term buy signal on TLT. When that occurs, we'll add to that position as well. But we're looking for this rally to either raise some more cash or re-add our short market position. So there was really nothing much for us to do this week. We're just kind of letting the equities participate in the market right now.
Okay. Well, great. And again, that, like I said, that's the benefit of having a plan and sticking to it. If the data hasn't changed, then just stick to the plan, right?
Exactly.
All right. So we are now building up kind of a pretty long list of topics that this audience here has asked us to kind of do a deep dive into at some point in time. And I'm letting folks know that it's very much on our radars here, folks. It's just all about sort of finding the bandwidth to be able to do this. But there's retirement planning. Folks wanted to deep dive in that. They wanted to deep dive in financial literacy, especially for teaching your children. They wanted one about insurance. We also spent a fair amount of time talking about sort of the psychology with money and relationships how that can be a massive stressor and best practices for kind of getting people on the same page for having harmony in your relationship around money. A lot of interest in that. I want to bring up another topic. I put up a tweet the other day, it was last weekend, where all I said was, hey, folks, I hope you invest in your health this weekend. And I think you and I have maybe made a throwaway comment or two about how, look, money's great, but if you don't have the health to enjoy it, you know, then it's not really worth anything, right? And I know that you, Lance, you told part of your sort of origin story around money last week, and you talked about starting a whole bunch of different martial arts studios across Texas. I have my own health background, but you know, so I it's funny. I put up a clip of me doing a deadlift.
I saw that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was great. A lot of people said, hey, that's wonderful. That's an inspiration. I'm going to go do something this weekend too. And I love the fact that everybody, you know, the vast majority of folks were saying, I'm going to take that as you know, my inspiration this week to go do a little bit of extra something that's going to make me a bit healthier. That was the whole point of it. It's funny. There were some people who really pushed back on it for one reason or another. I guess that's probably why I want to talk about it today, which is I've been around enough to see people who, you know, sort of feel daunted by the commitment that kind of getting back into shape or just developing a healthier lifestyle. It can feel really daunting if you kind of feel stuck. And I want to have folks hear a little bit from you, Lance, about the importance of making sure that you reserve bandwidth in your life to invest in your actual physical living capital. Because as I said earlier, my belief is if you don't have that, then the rest doesn't really matter very much in life, because you're not going to be around long enough to enjoy it, or you're not going to be in a state where you can enjoy it very well. So I see you nodding a little bit as I'm saying this, but why don't I let you run here for a minute?
Yeah. So I have been in fitness for a long time. You know, part of what I didn't tell you in our last time is that actually one of the things I did in life is I used to build big health and fitness facilities, you know, kind of like Lifetime Fitness or Bali's, you know, health and fitness. I don't know what you have out in California, Gold's 24-hour fitness, whatever. We used to build these big 13,000 square foot health and fitness facilities. And we would do corporate, you know, health. We were doing measuring health and, you know, creating diet plans for corporate workers. And this was long before, you know, and this was at a time where most gyms were just, you know, kind of these little sweatshops that were tucked away, just heavy weights, free weights, you know, big, you know, muscle heads were all going there. But we actually created a facility where it was more developed towards creating a better corporate culture and corporate health and lifestyle. Because one of the big challenges that corporations have is with the health of their employees. And as they get older, in particular, they get more and more sick time, more and more injuries on the job, et cetera, particularly if there are jobs where there's a lot of lifting required, et cetera. So, you know, providing these health and fitness programs was helping reduce their healthcare costs. So it was a big benefit for the company. So we did that. But I've been a big health and fitness buff my whole life. So, you know, even now I'm 57. I work out 7 days a week. I run 15 miles every weekend. I work out at least an hour a day in the gym during the week. And, you know, I take, and that's just me, right? It's just, that's part of my lifestyle that I've developed over time. And for me, what it does is it creates a stress relief away from work, because I work 16 to 18 hours a day every day. So, you know, that's my time away. And, you know, people ask me, it's like, well, you must really love working out. No, I hate working out. I would prefer to do anything other than go to the gym or go run. Right. I mean, that's just, you know, not what I want to do with my time, but I know that it's a requirement, and I have structured it in my life where it is just it's like a meeting for me. So every day, 9 o'clock in the morning, when I finish up our radio show, I do my post, whatever I got to do at 9 o'clock, I have a blocked out appointment on my calendar and I go to the gym. And from 9 to 10, I work out, and nobody bothers me during that period of time. You know, you can't schedule a meeting, you can't call me, you can't do nothing, but it just, it's a function of a regimen that you get yourself into. And this is one of the big problems, but let's talk about why health is important. The average person, when they retire, has roughly, and you and I have talked about this before, a median savings of roughly 1 year's worth of salary saved up. So going into retirement, they have about a year's worth of income saved up. So for the average person in America right now, that's about $60,000. That's not really going to carry you much through retirement in terms of living. And yes, you're going to have Social Security. Yes, you're going to have these other things, and that's all great. And yeah, you'll be able to, you know, probably work part-time through retirement, be okay, assuming you don't have any health problems. The average person is going to spend between $250,000 and $350,000 on their health between the time they retire. And most of that's going to be backloaded in their later years of retirement. And once you turn 70 and 80, you're going to, you know, that's when you really, a lot of these health problems set in. And a large majority of this is because of the lack of care that we bring to ourselves now, because we don't pay attention to our health, right? We don't eat well. We, you know, eat a lot of fast food, a lot of greasy food. We have a lot of sugar, a lot of salt, sodium, these type of things. And we don't work out. And yeah, right now we're overweight. We got, you know, can't see our feet, but it's okay. We feel all right now, but later this is all going to show up in terms of high blood pressure. And of course, weaker heart, cholesterol, all these type of things that lead to other problems from diabetes to a variety of other more severe illnesses. And, you know, spending your retirement, you know, you've worked your whole life to get to retirement. The thing of spending my retirement years in and out of hospitals really doesn't sound too appealing to me. So that's why I commit to that hour a day of committing to my exercise program. And I eat, you know, I have a very strict eating regimen, these type of things. But I've developed this over a very long period of time. Now, does this mean that I don't have hamburgers and pizza and other stuff every now and then? Yeah, absolutely. No sense in doing all this if I can't enjoy life along the way. We're about to go on vacation. I guarantee you on vacation, I'm going to eat a lot of crap because that's, you know, that's the whole benefit of doing this, but that's okay. To get started, I had a great health coach. His name was Keith Klein, and he actually did some, kind of some movies about eating, right? And all the lies about nutrition that we get. The worst thing that you can do is all these diets that are out there, the keto diet, this diet and that diet. They're terrible. And the reason that they're terrible is because you can't stick to them long-term. And as soon as you get off the diet, everything that you had benefited from it is going to come right back and more. And this is why we go through these yo-yo cycles in diets. And so dieting is a very, very dangerous thing to do for most people because of the inability to stick to it long-term. What you can stick to long-term, though, is developing an eating program that you can live with. And this was the whole basis of Keith Klein's program that I adopted, you know, 20 years ago. And, you know, one of the things that he said, and this is the most important thing, he says, make better bad choices. And I use this line a lot in you know, managing money as well. If you're going to take risk in the markets by making a better choice about the risk you take. But when it comes to eating, he just says, make better bad choices. And what does that mean? So look, you're going to go out and have a hamburger. Okay. Awesome. Get it without cheese. Maybe no mayo. Maybe use mustard instead of mayo. Get it without cheese. It's a start. You're reducing some calories, reducing some of the cholesterol. It's a start in the right direction. You're still eating bad, but it's a better bad choice. And then try to offset that with some better choices, eating, you know, a healthy salad or other stuff that you can work into your diet over time. And, you know, take a good multivitamin that can help. A good multivitamin that's well designed can alleviate a lot of problems if you can just make that a part of your regimen and just go walking. You know, one of the best things that I do for my relationship with my wife is that my wife and I, we run together or walk together. And, you know, a lot of times we'll just go take on a Sunday, we'll just go out, we'll walk for 5 miles, and we just spend that time connecting, right? Talking about the kids, talking about life. But at the same time that we're using this time just to communicate, be by ourselves and talk with each other, we're also doing something healthy for our lifestyle. And this leads to better outcomes over time. It's not fun. I'm not gonna, you know, paint anything over this and say that, you know, trying to be healthy is fun and boy, what a joy it is. It's not, but if you do it and can make it part of your lifestyle, it becomes a non-burden. It becomes a habit. It takes about 21 days to form a habit. And once you can form that habit, then it just becomes a habit. It's like getting up in the morning, putting on your underwear before you put your pants on, right? It's just, you know, it becomes a habit.
It's part of your lifestyle. And just to put words in your mouth that you can feel free to correct, but like, yeah, you know, working out is probably never, you know, going to feel like, you know, getting massaged with rose petals. but you feel better, right? When you are fit, when you are in shape, when you are healthier, you feel better generally, right? And that's a big part of the wellness that we're talking about, because when you feel better and you can do more things, then you get to roll around the floor with your grandkids, or you get to go travel and climb mountains. You're not going from hospital room to hospital room. Great feedback. I'll tell folks about a resource in just one second, but the main thing I was looking for you to do, which I think you did do well, which is to say that you work with, you know, hundreds of people every year that you're seeing through the arc of their lives, right? As they're planning for their future, and then you see them as they go into their future. And I've got to imagine that you see people you see the difference between those who have invested not only in their finances, but also in their health. You can see 5, 10, 15 years down the different trajectories, the very different trajectories those people go on. Right? I see you nodding vigorously here.
No. I mean, look, and this goes to a lot of things. I had a guy, just a quick example. I was strongly encouraging him to buy life insurance. And he kept putting me off. And there were some reasons that, you know, I was really, for him in particular, pushing him to buy some life insurance for his financial plan. Kept putting me off, didn't want to do it. It heard all the bad things about buying permanent life insurance, Dave Ramsey, you know, et cetera. Finally convinced him to go do it. Had to go do his meds. By the time he went and got his meds, had cancer. So, you know, the problem is that, you know, all of this relates back ultimately to not only what we do for ourselves. And, you know, you and I were talking about health and fitness from the standpoint of us living in our retirement years and being healthy in retirement and being able to enjoy our retirement. But let's not also forget that it's also about our family, our spouse, our kids. Being able
to continue to provide for your family. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and just enjoy them, but also not being a burden on them. Right. You don't want to spend your retirement years of them having to wait on you in hospitals, having to take care of you. I mean, and this is, you know, one thing I talk about a lot with parents who talk about, well, I have to pay for my kids' college. I'm like, you can't afford to pay for your kids' college. You don't have enough money for retirement. And that's great. You want to pay for their kids' college. That's awesome. But what are you going to do when they're out of college and they're having to support you in retirement? Now you're a burden on your children. Is that really the legacy you want to live?
Right. I'm going to interrupt you on that because let's just earmark that for a whole other
That's
discussion.
A whole other thing. But all ties together.
But it does. And to your point, you know, if you're not in good health, you could become a huge drain to your spouse or your kids or both of them if they're getting stuck with high cost medical bills. Okay. So real quick, folks. In the world that I ran in before I founded Wealthion, we did talk about health an awful lot. And I'm going to make available here a video that we did with a functional health expert. It sounds somewhat similar to the fellow that you were just talking about, Lance. Mm-hmm. And remind us of his name so folks can go Google him as well.
Keith Kline, K-L-I-N-E.
Okay, great. So the doctor that I'm going to recommend for folks here to go watch this video on, so he put together for one of a conference that we did a few years back, I asked him to do kind of a primer on functional health. And there's a lot that goes into it, but there's sort of four really big key pillars. There's nutrition. And I differentiate that from going on a diet like Lance was just ranting about. Nutrition really is how you develop healthy eating habits that you can stick to, you know, for the long haul. And I got to say, folks, if you're looking to change both your health and also how you look, it's kind of unfair, but nutrition is like 90% of it. It's the least fun part, in my opinion, but it's the one that makes the most difference. And Lance is giving me a big thumbs up. Okay, here, it's not that he agrees as I'm saying this. So it's getting your nutrition dialed in. Then it's functional fitness. It's how do you work out in ways that are, you know, you're not just trying to bulk up to impress people at the beach, but that can be kind of a nice side benefit. But you are strengthening the key elements of your body, your core, et cetera, that are just going to help you be more functional in the things that you want to do in your life. And it's going to just give you a lot more future mileage than if you're not taking advantage of your body's systems. So it's nutrition, it's functional fitness. Then it's sleep hygiene. And to be honest, as Americans, for sure, we are horrible with sleep hygiene, you know, with just the number of hours we sleep. And of course, we're looking at all these digital devices before we go to bed, and the blue light from them just totally screws up our REM sleep cycles. So we are constantly sort of sleep malnourished. So dialing your sleep in actually makes a really big difference. And then last is stress reduction, stress management. Our modern lifestyle is filled with all sorts of stressors that actually take a toll over time on our immune systems. So anyways, go to wealthion.com/health and watch that presentation. I think it's like about a half hour or so. He gives a lot of good, really sort of specific entryways in each one of those four areas I talked about that really anybody at any age can follow. And honestly, Lance, this topic deserves a lot more time than we're giving it here, but we got to begin to wrap things up. Say something.
Two things real quick. One is that if you want to spend some time actually going into this in more detail, we can go through the math of nutrition And there's a very simple process in terms of making better bad choices and getting your health and lifestyle kind of from the eating perspective in place. You know, people think when you talk about eating better that you just got to eat, you know, just you got to go all vegetarian. And that's absolutely not true. It's all about running a calorie deficit. And yeah, you can pretty much eat anything you want. You just have to run a calorie deficit. And what you have to figure out is how to calculate that and how you eat and how often you eat. So we can go through that sometime. I think it'd be great. But one of the best benefits, and you didn't cover this, you hit all the red areas. But the one thing that we don't talk about enough is, you know, when we got married, when you got married, when I got married, we married these beautiful women, and they were beautiful and sexy. And, you know, it was, you know, just the love of our lives and still are, right? They're still our princesses, you know, and then we kind of get into this lifestyle where we gain weight and we don't take care of ourselves as much. And then we start complaining about why we're not having, you know, as much of a romantic, you know, kind of sex life as we once did. And, you know, the one thing about getting in shape and one thing that, you know, that my wife and I both committed to a long time ago was taking care of our health, because, you know, being attracted to another person is not just about what you see outside. It's also about the person inside. But if you don't care about, you know, one half or the other, eventually that begins to erode into the lifestyle. And you know, we talked about infidelity because of money, you know, but also health plays a bit of a role in this. If you're constantly sick, don't feel good, you're not having sex with your wife, you're not being romantic with your wife, that has as much of a bearing on the outcome of the health and quality of your relationship as financial stress.
I totally would agree. And I think, I can't remember if I mentioned it, we were talking about sort of money issues and relationships, but money is one of the big three, right? Yep. And it's money, sex, and kids in that order. So you're reinforcing a very important one. Yep. All right, on that, we're going to start to wrap things up here, folks. Real quick, a couple people have reached out and said, hey, Adam, did you reach out to me on Wealthion? Because I got this comment, I saw this comment on YouTube with this Wealthion asked me to text them, and I did, and I got in this conversation with this guy who was trying to sell me Bitcoin. Totally not Wealthion. So I just want to let you know, if I can find an example of one of those, I'll put it up on the screen here. But this is a function of YouTube and the holes in its spam defense, but not uncommon for folks who post a comment beneath this video here to have somebody impersonating Wealthion respond to it. The good news is it's pretty obvious that it's not an official comment from Wealthion, usually because it's saying, hey, reach out to me. And they provide usually either a Telegram or a WhatsApp number. So just know that Wealthion is never going to give you a personal comment response and say, hey, contact me at this number. We're certainly never going to reach out to you through a phone and try to sell you a product.
Especially Bitcoin.
Yeah, especially things like cryptos. So anyways, just know that if you see something suspicious, trust your gut, it is suspicious. All right, so as we wrap up here, real quick, to go watch that health video, go to wealthion.com/health. And if you've enjoyed this, if you're enjoying these weekly market recaps, I told Lance we were going to be challenged to get this one under an hour and a half. I think we've indeed gone over. So if you're still watching, thank you for sticking around. But if you want us to continue doing this, do us a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button and clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Lance, thanks so much for giving so much of your time again here this week. Whatever happens in the coming week, we will be tracking it here together in next week's recap. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.